Hello, everyone. I'm an Indigenous elder of the Eastern Cherokee and Muscogee tribes, and you're listening to the Awakened Underground podcast.
This podcast represents the opinions and experience of its hosts and guests for educational and informational purposes only.
Psychedelic plant medicines are sacred technologies that have been stewarded by Indigenous people around the world since before recorded history.
As these Indigenous wisdoms enter the mainstream culture, we ask you to please operate from a place of respect
and reciprocity as to end the exploitation and colonization of First Nations people.
It's imperative to use immense caution when embarking on your journey to work with psychedelic medicines,
as they are powerful tools for human transformation that are not to be taken lightly.
Information shared within this podcast should not be taken as medical advice.
Awakened Underground, its guests, and partners are not liable for any actions of your choosing.
With that said,
we trust you will make responsible and ethical choices under your own free will.
What's up, gang? I'm your host, Cody Blue, and this episode's called Healing Generational Trauma.
This is your brain on drugs.
This is your brain on drugs.
America's public enemy number one.
To a new and dangerous area, the use of hallucinogens.
Bad trip. A bummer, a freak out, even a flip out.
Don't let drugs ruin your future.
Both call it not a war on drugs, but a war on
consciousness.
You are now entering the Awakened Underground Podcast.
It was February 8th, 2020. My fiancée, Tanya Dahl, had brought me to this ayahuasca circle to sit with two beautiful young shamans for the first time, a man and a woman, a husband and a wife. When we arrived, the male facilitator greeted us warmly, but strangely, was without his female counterpart. When we asked where she was, he told us she was flying in from out of the country and having flight delays, and that she might not make it to that night's ceremony. He added that they had not seen each other for some time, and it was causing a lot of stress on their relationship. He graciously instructed us to find a seat in the maloka and prepare for the ceremony. But then, there was another problem. The ceremony was overbooked and overcrowded. We watched as 40 people packed into this tiny maloka, almost all of them very large, muscular men. Most of these men had traveled from all over the world to be there, and when they entered the circle, they were very standoffish with their chest pushed out, avoiding eye contact, and not greeting anyone. Now, in an ideal world, you want a medicine ceremony to be a healthy balance of both men and women to help bring equanimity to the space. Traditionally, a medicine ceremony is held in a circle because it helps create an even flow of energy around the room, as a circle is the symbol of unity, connection, and the literal practice of physically assembling ourselves in a manner that is harmonic. But in this particular ceremony, due to the overflow of participants, it was decided they would set up the seating in concentric circles, placing the 7 women in the middle and the 33 men in a larger circle around the women. A little surprised by this, as it is an energetically vulnerable position to have someone behind you like that in a ceremony, I made sure to sit directly behind my fiancé and the beloved woman we came with. The clock struck 7, and it was time to begin the ceremony, but the female facilitator was still nowhere to be found. Unable to wait any longer, the male shaman began the opening ritual, calling in the 4 directions, performing a blessing on the space, and opening the first cup of ayahuasca to be served. That is when the female shaman entered the maloka, out of breath, exhausted, carrying her oversized bags and heavy instruments. Everyone looked to her and burst into applause, happy to see her, as the husband and wife embraced, holding each other in an intimate moment of reconnection that seemed to hold within it implications far greater than any of us could have known. With tears in his eyes, the male shaman decided to start the entire ceremony over, now that his partner was rightfully by his side. One by one, each participant approached the altar and received their cup of ayahuasca and stated their intention before drinking the sacrament. I downed the medicine, a thick dark brown molasses that tasted like fermented sticks and burnt caramel, a taste that somehow gets harder to stomach every time I drink it. I took my seat, along with everyone else, and suddenly, the room began to get very dark, and a heaviness slowly entered the space. This is a feeling I've grown very familiar with, as it usually means that Mother Ayahuasca is about to teach us all a very hard lesson. The next thing I knew, I felt sicker and sicker and sicker as I began to hear an orchestra of violent purging, a cacophony of moans, groans, and anguish as the circle released their illness into their respective buckets. Although oddly, the purging was predominantly coming from the women at the center of the circle. The pain grew so bad that I began to pray for a purge to take away the pain in my stomach. But instead, I was forced to sit with this heaviness, a heaviness unlike anything I had ever felt before. With this overwhelming, literal weight I felt on my shoulders, I collapsed onto my elbows and knees, with my hands clasped, staring into the floor, beginning to question why I do this medicine work at all. My consciousness began to glitch between this dimension and someplace else, adding disorientation to discomfort. Growing desperate, I began to bargain with the medicine, saying, "Please, grandmother, what is this pain? What is this weight I'm feeling?" The next thing I knew, I was transported to the very beginning of the human timeline, where I was shown the first time a man harmed a woman as a means of controlling her. And that is when the medicine spoke to me, saying,
"This pain is the curse of the patriarch. This pain is the persecution of the Divine Mother, the Sacred Sister, and the Creator herself. This curse is the source of all imbalance in the one and all disease in the many."
As the medicine spoke, I trembled as I witnessed the first woman in all her sacredness, in all her power, in all her divinity, be oppressed and controlled by her masculine counterpart, abusing his superior physical prowess to control the feminine's superior metaphysical prowess. As the medicine spoke, feeling as if a knife were in my stomach, I watched a barrage of images of women, mothers, sisters, and daughters being raped, abused, assaulted, oppressed, subjugated, maligned, insulted, and cast aside. Old women ignored, young women sexually objectified, and women of all colors, creeds, and ages sacrificed their body, health, mind, and spirit in the birthing process to be the physical creators of new life in this world, to ultimately be maligned and cast aside by society. As someone who has always identified as a feminist, I began to agree with her, saying the words, I know, this is terrible, I know. In which the medicine replied,
"You know nothing. To say I know means no. It means you have ceased learning, you have ceased growing, and you have ceased listening."
In this place of pure anguish, I was shown a vision of my partner Tanya, sitting in a park, leading her very first public meditation class, with an empty space next to her that was supposed to be occupied by me. A few months prior to the ceremony, Tanya was leading this meditation, and right beforehand, Tanya had decided that she didn't want me to come because she was too nervous. And instead of me speaking to her insecurity and making sure I was there to support her, I selfishly obliged her to see a friend who was in from out of town. Despite Tanya being a practitioner of meditation for 10 years and being one of the most incredible spiritual teachers I know, the lack of support she had that day led Tanya to feel an overwhelming imposter syndrome that led to her discontinuing her meditation classes for many years after that. The medicine then told me that I needed to support and hold up the women in my life because of this greater transgenerational burden that they bear. I was told that the awakening in humankind is a shift to honoring the sacredness of women, and that women needed to be at the center of this change in order to restore and rebalance the world. And as a man, it was my responsibility to learn from them and support them and protect them. This ceremony taught me about the importance of balancing the masculine and feminine energies in the world, as well as how much healing and atonement needs to be implemented and practiced to truly mend these ancient wounds. Even beyond the lessons of healing the persecution of the feminine, I learned the very real gravity of generational trauma, and that the women in my life were not just experiencing the social inequities of being a woman, but they were also carrying with them the burden of the collective female trauma that all women before them have endured. Sadly, this phenomenon of transgenerational trauma extends beyond the oppression of women, but to all the communities of people who have experienced psychological trauma throughout time as a shared collective memory. This includes the colonization and genocide of First Nations people, the descendants of the Atlantic slave trade, Jewish Holocaust survivors, victims of Jim Crow laws, the apartheid of South Africa, the Salem witch trials, religious persecution, Oliver Cromwell's genocide in Ireland and Irish discrimination in Scotland, the colonization of African countries, India, Australia, Aboriginals, and any group experienced any form of subjugation, oppression, segregation, or persecution. This is something we watch people face and heal in ceremony on a regular basis, but the field of scientific research into generational trauma is relatively young, although expanding greatly in recent years. Transgenerational trauma was first recognized in the children of Holocaust survivors in 1966. Psychologists began to observe large numbers of children of Holocaust survivors seeking mental help in clinics in Canada. The grandchildren of Holocaust survivors were overrepresented by 300% among the referrals to psychiatry clinics in comparison with the representation in the general population. The more recent research has proven that this extends beyond oppressed communities and can affect groups based around one's identity, like those who identify with the LGBTQ+ community, which was illuminating for me to learn, as for many years, I was experiencing great shame and fear of persecution around sharing what I had learned about psychedelic medicines, ceremonial technologies, and the metaphysical nature of reality. I would often in ceremony have to relive witch burnings, stonings, crusades, crucifixions, and public persecution throughout the ages. These visions were horrific to experience in ceremony, but the worst part of reliving these events were the feelings of betrayal and public humiliation, as I would watch as my beloved community looked on and did nothing, sometimes even cheering, as I was publicly ridiculed, tortured, and murdered for speaking out against the government, corruption, and the church. But even beyond identity, gender, race, and oppressed communities, most recently, in the past decades, this field of research has expanded with the insights gleaned by the Human Genome Project, which discovered that transgenerational trauma can affect all humans and animal kind, as any individual who undergoes extreme stress is susceptible to pass on trauma to their genetic offspring through a process known as epigenetics. Epigenetics is the phenomenon of how behavior and environment can cause changes that affect the way genes work. Unlike genetic changes, epigenetic changes are reversible and do not change our DNA sequence, but they can change how our body reads and interprets said DNA sequence. This phenomenon illustrates one of the main teachings I seek to share on this show, and that is the interconnectedness of all beings. Pain, disease, and trauma may be experienced on an individual level, but the science and teachings of psychedelic medicines are revealing that they are actually felt on a much larger collective level. And until we wake up to this truth and understand that we are not well until all of us are well, we will repeat these cycles of failure over and over and over again, and continue to pass on our pain to each other, our children, and our children's children. But if we can wake up to this truth, that we are all one and we are all connected, we can cease fighting for change on the streets and on the battlefield, and turn our gaze inward and focus our energy towards the healing of ourselves, pulling the rot out by the root, knowing that doing so will systematically break this wheel of trauma and free the future generations from the pain of the past, so we can release the tyranny of the old world and welcome in a new one, where we are all united, healthy, happy, and whole again.
I do look at my family members differently now, and people that I meet, because I understand that we're all dealing with trauma that we didn't experience.
We don't know how to have these difficult dialogues. Now it's time to look at the batons we've been passing on. So it is up to all of us to create a future of healing, to be the gold that patches the society and the next generation.
Trauma can affect future generations too. For example, in a study of 100 Holocaust survivors, researchers found that their children were more likely to get a PTSD diagnosis, even though they didn't report any more traumatic experience in their lives than a similar control group did.
Trauma could also be inherited biologically, sort of like what gets passed on through our genes.
Studying methylation is part of the field of epigenetics, the study of what can be inherited or passed on from parent to child biologically, but outside of the actual letters of your DNA.
Lead to transgenerational changes that affect multiple generations. If you change the production of small RNAs in the brains of the ancestors, it changes the physiology and the behavior of the descendants, even the grandchildren.
On today's episode, we have joining us a powerful and brilliant woman, Lauren Taus, a yogi and a psychotherapist that specializes in psychedelic-assisted therapies. Lauren integrates alternative medicines of treatment into her work, focusing on embodying techniques to support integrative health in mind, body, heart, and spirit. She is trained in ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for complex PTSD by MAPS, and has also studied extensively with David Emerson at the Trauma Institute in Boston to learn the art of trauma-sensitive yoga. Lauren is a kind soul and an awakened woman that courageously leads with her heart, and we couldn't be more honored to have her on the show to discuss her journey to working with psychedelic medicines and how they can help us heal generational trauma.
The Awakened Underground Podcast.
I would love to start by hearing your story to how you got to working with psychedelic medicine.
Sure. Well, I spent so much of my life being good. I think my favorite poem is called Wild Geese by Mary Oliver. And the first line is, you do not have to be good, right? So the conditioning that had me wanting to be perfect and really was painful. And a reaction, I think, to my family and to what was happening around me. And so that had me like a straight A student, editor of the newspaper, community service queen, like competing in rhythmic gymnastics around the world and doing all sorts of things that made me look good. Right?
Right.
I certainly wasn't partying in high school or college. Drugs were definitely not on the good list. I had a lot of thoughts about drugs that I think the society still carries.
Right.
And it wasn't until much later in my life that it made any sense. And of course, when I first started my journey work, it still was confrontive and scary and all of that.
Same. It's still a tough programming to shed, for sure.
Yeah. And I didn't do it until I was in my early 30s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It took me a long time. And I would say like the long and short answer to how I got to psychedelics is really my own suffering, right? And the suffering that I've inherited from my lineage and also the beauty, right? But my personal healing work from an eating disorder, from the loss of my sister, of my mother, had me going to therapy, had me in a yoga practice, and ultimately had me in Journey Space.
Did you, so you had an eating disorder, and yeah. were you at the time of the loss of your mother and your sister?
So my eating disorder really started at the end of high school.
Okay.
And it was concurrent with straight A's and all the achievements and all the symbols of success that a young person can collect. And I was starving. I was starving. My sister was dying at that time, and my mom was sort of dying with her.
Oh, my God. What would your sister, if you don't mind me asking?
Sure. My sister had cystic fibrosis. Ugh. Yeah. So I've done the death rodeo. And in many ways, death is something that I consider one of my favorite teachers. None of us are going to get out of this thing alive. None of us. And we don't really have a lot of language for death and dying. It's as if we want to keep it behind closed doors.
Right, right.
And when you really like sit with your own mortality, when you sit with the loss of a loved one, it can be an invitation to life. And as a little person, I didn't really understand that just yet. So as my sister was sick, I got sick. I got sick to get attention on some level. And my mother was very like concerned with my sister's dying, and I was at prep school achieving. So there was less kind of need to worry about Lauren.
I love that. I say this a lot on this show, but there's that great Eckhart Tolle quote, "The secret to life is to die before you die and discover death isn't real." And one of the amazing things about these medicines is that's typically the threshold you have to pass through before you can receive whatever medicine you need.
Totally.
To face your own mortality. And on the other side of that, we find sort of what limiting beliefs and programs often associated with death. So dealing with all of that and taking on all those heavy cultural programs, when you got to your 30s, what medicine were you called to, and how was it able to help you?
So, and I'm excited that we're going to talk about intergenerational work, because all of this is very family oriented for me. And I'm very passionate about generational work, generational psychedelic work. So my brother was in a men's group, my older brother, and he was doing some work with psychedelics in the container of this group. And he invited me. And I said no several times. And in fact, I signed up and then didn't show up. I was like, no, that's too scary.
Right, yeah, right. What psychedelics?
So it was Armand's medicine. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No.
Armand is a Peruvian kind of medicine formulator. And it's a combination of different things. I sort of almost look at it at this point, which I've flown the wings of many things many times now since then. But he, you know, stacks different medicines. And it's usually a heart opener and then a combination of a mushroom ayahuasca chocolate.
Oh, wow. Okay, gotcha.
And in that container, there's the assumption that there's medicine in the community. And so there's conversations that unfold and also opportunities to practice boundaries and all of these things in an elevated way. And when I did eventually go, it was with my brother. And it was literally biblical for me. The first journey was like biblical visuals, you know, caravans, animals going through the desert from my head into my heart while I laid in my brother's arms.
Yeah, same. And I also went with my brother, Shane, as well, to my first Aya ceremony. So I'm right there with you. But yeah, it's very, well, it's no joke. Yeah.
Yeah. And I knew at that point that I would continue to explore and that there was deep, deep healing for me in these spaces and places. And it wasn't until many years later that I understood that there was a possibility for me to cross-pollinate my work as a psychotherapist with psychoactive medicines. And when that became present, when I understood that I could, my life purpose was clear.
Wow. And I'd love to kind of like zoom into what you just said, because you used the term biblical. So my first question is, were you raised with Catholicism at all in your life?
No. I was raised Jewish and very like a Diet Coke Jew, very casual, you know, like we're not really keeping anything in a serious way. But I studied religion as an undergrad. I think I had a lot of existential distress as a young person. I didn't understand spirituality in a way that was resonant for me.
Yeah, same.
And I was quite scared of death and dying.
Yeah, same. And what, when you say biblical, and you don't have to be able to go too detailed, it's too much. Obviously, we don't want to like turn certain people off that have traumas around religiosity, but I think there is a religious nature to these medicines. I should say, it's definitely spiritual, yes. But the symbolism can be, as you said, biblical yes. often. And with myself, with my family, and mm-hmm. also with like patients I work with. So what did that look like for you? You said animals up and down your body, like while your brother held you. Like, can you tell us a little bit about what that first awakening experience
sure.
was for you?
Sure. And I want to also hold the frame with you that these medicines are often spiritual experiences for people in a way that's experiential, right? Like it's body-based. It's gnosis. It's not being taught from a book.
Right.
It's you know God, like whatever God means to you. I don't care what you call him, her, it, whether it's Jesus, Muhammad, like Buddha, good orderly direction. I don't
right.
care.
Right.
Like, but people have the experiential knowing of divine. And that's one of the measures that translates into the, you know, the most positive treatment outcomes in the therapeutic space, love and mystical experiences.
Wow, wow.
Yeah. So back to me. I'm laying in my brother's arms. And what was biblical was just like the story of the journey, you know, into the desert, right? And like leaving, you know, I mean, even we're just out of Passover. And Passover is the story of freedom. And it's leaving bondage and going into the unknown, really. You got to go. Like, you don't have time to think about it. You got to jump out of the airplane.
Right.
And it's, you know, when you celebrate Passover, there's an invitation to liberate yourself over and over and over again
right.
from the enslavements. And we all have them. I have them too. And you know, I mean, even for me this year, it was like, okay, so I still have some enslavement to image. I still have enslavement to my work even. I get really pretty addicted to my work.
Yes.
But these are some of the big ones. And you're meant to kind of go out and let them behind. So I was leaving some of the stories, some of the conditioning and journeying. And the visuals that were happening at the time were, was caravans and animals marching from my mind into my heart.
Wow.
Right? So taking the long journey home. As a clinician, as a therapist, as someone that gets to provide this type of work, I really believe that it's a homecoming journey.
Right.
Right? It's a return to our own innate goodness.
Right.
Through our own intuition.
There's a sense of that when you enter the space of returning home, you
yes.
know, whether it's feel like you're going into an afterlife or mm-hmm. you're reconnecting with sort of like a universal family on the other side, you know, and it's interesting because I always try to explain to people, because it's sort of like doing this work can be often like being a death doula,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm like, you know, you come into this world, you're shot out of a cosmic pussy and you come out and there's a bunch of strange people staring at you and you don't know who they are, but they know who you are and they've been waiting for you and they're going to show you this world and teach you the way and take care of you. And it's very similar when you enter that other side, when you have that interface, there is loving faces, call them ancestors, guides, spirit, whatever you want to call it. And they're going to take care of you. They're going to show you the way. They're there to help you. And they're going to, you know, it's very comparable to, you know, death and birth are, you know, one and the same
yes.
in many ways and
yes.
intrinsically connected. You know, it's just a new beginning,
yes.
a moving through a rites of passage, if you will. Yeah.
Totally. And in my mind, whenever someone is coming to therapy or to a psychedelic experience, it is for the dying. Something needs to be shed in order for the person to really live. And that letting go is scary, is sometimes painful. Sometimes it's blissful, right? Sometimes it's ecstatic, but there's something that needs to be transmuted, that needs to die off for the person to live.
Hey gang, pardon the interruption. We'll be back after a quick break from our sponsors. And now back to our regular scheduled deprogramming. Some of the conditions you were dealing with after you did that ceremony, did you experience reprieve or healing around whether it's the eating disorder or any depressive symptoms or your relationship with death around your sister and your mother and their transition? Did you get any reprieve from that ceremony or future ceremonies?
Future ceremonies, absolutely. They all perspective shift and they widen the aperture, right? The curtains open and you can see so much more.
I love that. That's so cool because there's layers to this.
Mm-hmm.
There's layers. Like,
yeah.
you know, and every time you mm-hmm. think, you know, people say, oh, why are you going to go back again? Well, there's a depth. You know, there's a depth. Like, what'd you say? Widening the curtain?
Widening the aperture. It's like the lens expands and there's just, oh, wow. Right? Like you get out of the smallness, out of the the story, right? We live in certain stories, and how do we change the narrative? Because storytelling is also one of the biggest medicines we have.
Right.
And for me, I mean, I've had deep, deep, deep levels of family healing. I also have invited and converted my father to psychedelic medicine.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. And my dad, I work with a number of physicians in my practice, but my dad's my primary prescriber. And he, you know, came to this type of work at 75.
Oh, my God.
And from the traditional Western medicine outlook of how are these drugs scheduled?
Right.
Right? So these drugs are scheduled at schedule one, which means that there's no medical application. They're unsafe and highly addictive. So these are bad, scary drugs. Mm-hmm. And I told my dad immediately after I had my first experience, and he is a sweet Jew from the Bronx, and he's like, you fucking doing drugs? My fucking straight A kid's doing drugs? Because this is how he speaks, okay?
My mom's from Brooklyn, so I feel you.
And that's how he speaks. And I'm like, not no, Dad, but let me explain it to you. He listened and he was scared, but he was curious. And I invited him to be mindful of the research. And the student in him, the doctor in him, did that. And he became aware that there are clinical applications, but I don't need that, right? And over time, I said, Dad, like, this, you're right, you don't actually need it. You're right, you don't need it. But the story that I tell myself is that you can have more access to your heart and you can be more of who you actually are. And sure enough, like, that, that's what happened. And the level of transformation that I've witnessed in my father over the last 3 years is astonishing. And I offer that as an example to everyone that, you know, an old dog can learn new tricks if the dog wants to learn, and it's never too late to change. And as his daughter working with psychedelic medicine in the context of psychedelic assisted therapy, I also get to be in the space of continued transmutation of the patterning that was set down before us that in many ways we co-signed without being present to the fact that it was even happening. And the level of consciousness that exists in our connection and love and commitment to living in a really good and beautiful way together as a family has been one of the biggest blessings in my life. And something that, you know, I want to share because I believe that it's all family work. I believe it's all family work.
I couldn't agree with you more. I believe it all comes down to the family. Everything is archetypal. The father, the son, the daughter, the mother. It's all archetypal. Mm-hmm. I brought my whole family to the medicine. It's been so beautiful to see because now I have my dad working on a microdose regimen to see a family gathering where instead of reaching for a glass of wine, everybody took a microdose and we're not even journeying, but it was just enough medicine for us to open our hearts a little bit and connect a little bit more and not need that sort of quote unquote social lubricant that people sort of reach for when they get together with their families. And it's truly healed my family and brought us so close. And you can't really quantify that a degree of healing. You know, it's how do you measure or do a double blind study for a healthy and whole family, you know? And I applaud you. I think that's so important. And that's the whole genesis of the show. The first episode was my entire family because I want people to understand that regardless, even if you don't have a formal prognosis of depression or OCD or whatever it may be, the healing your relationships and having more happiness and connection and being able to really appreciate, enjoy your time here and relish it like that, that's the medicine. And I'd ask you, your father, 75, an allopathic traditional doctor, had said he didn't need it, had no real, you know, pathology to cure, and you helped bring him to the medicine and you saw transformation. Can you share what that transformation looks like, you know, beyond the modern framework of taking symptom clusters, throwing a pathology and a medication on it? You know, what does transformation look like for people who might not be sick, but be interested in growing and expanding and evolving and having more levels of connection and happiness? What did that look like for your father?
What I can say very clearly is that my father has expanded and deepened his ability to listen to life, to listen to other people, to expand and include. My dad came from a very closed system with a lot of like Jewish paranoia, a lot of fear of the world being unsafe. And it was very unsafe for his ancestors. And so he operated with like a very tight armor. And he's softened and he has welcomed new people into his fold. My dad listens to music. He didn't really listen to music so much before. It was like distracting and it was annoying to him. Now he calls it psychedelic music. And sometimes he'll just, you know, lay down and just listen and journey inward. And now my father was also someone who was very committed to his evolution, but it looked much more traditional in psychoanalysis. My dad spent decades in psychoanalysis. Decades, like going, like with such commitment to clearing his system so that he could show up in a good way as a father. And still, there was stuff that was not moving and that has now moved. And he's more playful. He's more alive. He says he's never been happier, you know, and he's lost his wife, like my mother, who died 7 years ago. And he feels happy. He's also, my father was a pretty fierce atheist. And his words were, "I am the program and this is it. Game over." And these medicines have invited my dad into what he calls spirit space. That's his language. And, you know, he had in an ayahuasca journey, my father recognized, like, you cannot annihilate me. And he had this Jewish fear of annihilation, right? That the Jewish people there have been efforts to annihilate the people of his tribe. And he's like, you can't. Like, I can die, but there's no annihilation. And to really explore what it is to be part of something bigger than self and to feel that and know that on some level is brand new for him. And, you know, I consider myself quite a spiritual person. I love my Judaism. I connect with certain rituals of my tradition. And my faith is much bigger than any story of God. It's my own direct experience. And, you know, I've had many conversations with my father over my lifetime. But he even said the other day, he said, I prayed for someone. And my dad doesn't let that slide on. He's like, it's kind of like making a wish. And I'm like, you're the cutest person ever. But to be in the space of expanding what is, like what we're part of, maybe what we came here for, is brand new and absolutely a gift of psychedelics and absolutely something that he thanks me for. And I thank him for his openness and his courage to explore.
When he said, "I am the program," yeah. was that pre-medicine or post-medicine?
That was definitely pre-medicine.
That was pre-medicine?
Yeah.
So I really relate, you know, my great-grandfather, you know, escaped the Holocaust to come here. So I really am part Jewish and I relate to that. Now you talk about sort of this paranoia and all these programs that you saw in him that he was able to move past. Watching your father move past those, did that give you any insights into perhaps maybe a certain generational trauma that was indoctrinated into you when you talk about being very type A or wanting to be good or being maybe a little more fearful and less carefree than you are now? Was there witnessing of some healing of that generational trauma? And did you see any reflections of that within yourself? Looking back after you're on the other side of your healing and watching your father go through it?
I am my greatest project. I am absolutely still in progress.
Yeah,
and, and I enjoy it. And you know, when you open the doors to these types of experiences, these kinds of psychoactive engagements, you're also opening the door to intergenerational, transpersonal, and collective content. So we are not ever just having like a discrete experience of self. We are experiencing what I call the experience. And that is pretty, I mean, my dear friend Alexa says it's exquisite and it's excruciating. And if you look at planet Earth and what's happening here and what's happened here, there's savagery in my backyard, right? I live in Venice and there's a lot of untreated psychosis, which to me is trauma.
Right.
You know, that's a lot of untreated trauma. And when you look at, you know, countries and other places that are at war, we are all connected. Like separation is an illusion. So I'm not ever going to be clear of it, right? Because I'm part of it.
Exactly.
And from a generational perspective, I'm such a big fan of the work of Rachel Yehuda. I was able to do my MAPS MDMA training with her. And she's a scientist who has really, really focused on epigenetics.
Yep.
And the study of how our genetic expression changes according to our experiences and, of course, then gets passed on. And she looked at she has looked at the offspring of Holocaust survivors, as well as the offspring of Vietnam War vets and pregnant women who survived the attacks at 9/11.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and oftentimes the people, the offspring are presenting with symptoms that would make so much more sense for their parents to have, but the children have them, right? And you know, when she created the Mount Sinai Center for Holocaust survivors, who came was not the survivors themselves, but their children, and so that sort of was an inspiration for her to look at this more deeply. Wow. And you know, we all carry the experiences of the ones who came before us, like genetically.
Right.
And I think for me, learning to feel safe in my body has been a really juicy journey. And to be in my body, which I really think is a spiritual practice. You know, we're all going to leave our bodies in time. Can we be in them now? Can we feel in them now, right? It's through the body that we feel and heal, right? You can't think a feeling. So traditional psychotherapy can be often very cognitive. I'm super, super like jazzed and pumped about the interventions that engage the body, like any sort of somatic experiencing, EMDR, parts work is brilliant. But like really getting in here is a spiritual journey. And I think based on the lack of safety that, you know, comes through my father's lineage and my mother also had a lot of sexual trauma in her experience, which I have not had in mine. But I believe I carry some of the symptomology of someone who would.
Right. I'm noticing that a lot, and even universally with mm-hmm. women I work with mm-hmm. in the space, including mm-hmm. my partner and my siblings, women, even if it's not them personally, they really carry the collective trauma of women mm-hmm. of sexual abuse. It's really tragic. It's actually your partner, Dr. Nick, when we had him on the show, I was like, are you having a male and a female? You know, are you making sure there's a woman there? Because I think it's so important, because so much of the female people I work with, that comes up. And, you know, it's so important for a woman to be able to step in and for me to be able to fade into the background for holding space. So, because that is that burden, even if I don't think, you know, every woman has experienced it, they share it. We all share it. Even men, we share that as well. But women really are the one are bearing the burden and working through that in these ceremonies.
It's part of the experience of being a woman, right? For eons, like our bodies have been, you know, attacked and abused. And, you know, there's nothing more divine to me than the female body. There's nothing more godlike. We create life.
The portal of divinity.
Unbelievable. Yep.
Portal of creation.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm aware in my personal experience that I carry a lot of that isn't mine per se. Right. But it is in so much as like it's in my experience. It's in my field. It's in how I relate to this this skin suit. And I work on it. I I've made so much progress. Wow. I hated my body. I hated my body. I wanted nothing to do with this thing. And now I have such a friendly relationship with her. And in such a like I listen to the wisdom that comes from this vessel. And I like my body now. I really do. It's astonishing. Like I would have never thought that I would come to like my form.
When you talk about your eating disorder, mm-hmm. you know, that within itself is a patriarchal, that's a wound around a patriarchal program of mechanisms and ideas and beliefs that were put into place to control women a long time ago. And whether it filters out or is rippled out to the women being portrayed in a very specific light in the media, and that leading to, you know, your young Lauren, you know, feeling, you know, oh, you had to look a certain way or whatever, and it manifested in this eating disorder. I mean, that's all a female wound. And I know this is a little woo, but I really do believe it's this really kind of ironic metaphor for someone who was very atheist coming to this healing. And so much of my spiritual interfaces are very feminine. Mm. They're very feminine. The earth is depicted often as a woman. You know, ayahuasca, the spirit of that medicine, is feminine. Mm-hmm. You know, understanding that, you know, all of us are women, and the mutation is to become male in the womb, and that it's almost like that pole position is female, that spiritual nature is feminine, and this bastardization, this control, this oppression is on kind of spirit itself, mm-hmm. you know. And I know that's very woo to say, but I've had hard ceremonies mm-hmm. around masculinity and women. It's always called to me the curse of the patriarch is what was always called to me in ceremony. So I mean, to hear you just go into this. I really appreciate you bringing this to the light of day, because this is something that, you know, men, my brothers, like, we all need to hold space for and realize that, you know, this is sort of where the pendulum needs to swing as far as where we are in order for collective healing. You know, you talk about us all being connected, and the family, you know, it's the closest branch on the tree, and it's really where we need to start, is with ourselves and our family. But it's so much more than that. We really are all connected. And when you peel back that curtain and those layers start to peel off, I mean, now when I enter a space, I don't really talk about this publicly that often, but it's still something I'm processing, but I feel the pain of everybody in the circle, wherever it is, you know, and what is that, you know, opening up to this greater and greater empathy, you know, this awakening to this, to us being connected. The language of that is this empathic transmission. You know, we know women are so much more empathetic than a lot of men. I don't want to divide us. I want to bring us together here, but you know what I'm saying?
I do. And you know, Gabor Mate talks about a mother hatred wound as being what we're doing to planet Earth. And there is this, you know, Mother Earth, grandmother in ayahuasca. And, you know, even Judaism talks about the God as having a feminine presence on the planet.
Oh, wow.
And I also don't want to, I want to just appreciate that we have been spoon-fed like a woman act and a man act, right? Which sucks and strangles both of us.
Right. That's why, like, I don't want to perpetuate the binaries, but at the same time, I want to honor the pain of the past and the pain of that's still happening today.
Yeah. And it's the system that we operate in is very sick. Is very, very sick. And I think in many ways, modern affluence has us sicker than ever before. And so overly obsessed with self, right? Like self-fulfillment, self-development, self-reliance, self-empowerment, self. I'm exhausted with myself, right? Like, I'm like, yes. I like, yes, self. But you know, Gandhi said we find ourselves when in the service of others, like when we lose ourselves in the service of others. And we live in a world where we've really collapsed the need for collaboration, if you have enough, right? And so people are just at home with their stuff alone. Like and our level of aloneness has been amplified. So for me, it all comes back to the family and the home. And the invention of the nuclear family in the 50s was a massive failure, right? Like, we used to live in much bigger, like, families where there were many eyes tracking the little ones. And we need that, right? Like, even my brother's wife just got back from Peru today. She was visiting her grandmother. And I was aware that, like, my niece, who's almost three, and she's one of my favorite teachers. She's my muse. I love her so, so much. She needed more, you know? So my dad showed up. But there used to be much bigger tribes, like, looking after us.
Right. Right.
And we really need that. Like, we need to be more collaborative and caring of each other and less obsessed with, like, our own selves.
Right. I always try to put it into a binary, like, illness, just connection and disconnect, you know. And obviously when where your mind goes, your energy goes. So if your mind is on the self, the energy is essentially, it's blocking the flow of energy. It's supposed to go outward, and we're supposed to be able to receive and give. And that's sort of how the flow of energy is in reciprocity. And if it's just going towards the self, it's going to create stagnation, and we're going to start to have blockages. Hey, gang, we'll be back with more after this quick break. Sorry for the interruption. More Awakened Underground now. So one of the things I would love to get in with you is, because you were just talking about epigenetics. Would you be down speaking on some of the scientific breakthroughs around epigenetics? We talk a lot about that study with mice and rose blossom. You know, when they bred a bunch of mice, they would shock their feet lightly and emit the smell of rose blossom. And then after that, they would, for generations, they would breed mice distant from that experience. But when they then put the smell of rose blossom back into the cage, the mice would all panic. They had an increased anxiety and fear response. That trauma was in them. And in sort of doing these scans on their brains, they actually grew neurons for that rose blossom. They heightened, it was baked into their neurology to be prepared for the smell of rose blossom. And that meant fear, you know. Also, we haven't spoke on this on the show yet, but a study with mice around, they would give the fathers these certain mice cocaine, and their kids actually, the baby mice actually were less likely to do cocaine because cocaine's toxic, and they would develop some sort of mechanisms for fighting or some sort of wisdom within themselves of that experience. So it sort of goes both ways. And this goes into, you know, there's studies on women who are very anxious while they're pregnant and how they give birth and how that transfers. And the same is true on the other side of the spectrum for positivity, you know, being lighter, having less anxiety, having more of a positive environment, and how that can literally, change the neurochemistry or the way the DNA of that child interacts with itself. Can you get a little into this sort of where the science
is? You dropped
is?
A lot of different, opened a lot of proverbial tabs. Yeah. I'm going to do my best to respond to them.
Give me a little bit of the tea, spill the tea on some of the science, because I know it's still sort of young, and I think these medicines are breaking us through. They're leaping us so far past where the science is, but the science is far enough that we can still sort of point to it.
Totally. And I just want to say that I'm not a scientist, so there's probably someone who's better equipped to answer this. I will say that, you know, our ability to adapt to our environment is unilaterally a good thing, right? So we do. And our genetic expression, like the stress hormones often get shifted. There's a large body of research around this that, I'm not a scientist, like I said, so I'm not as able to articulate that, but this does get passed on. And then this is like, has been tracked and researched. So now if someone is in a war environment and they have hypervigilance, and then that kind of energy gets passed on to their child who's not in a war, it's no longer useful, but they may still have that sense of dysregulation in their body that then they need to kind of shift. The good news is that there's neuroplasticity, that there is the opportunity to change, that we do change, right? So I would invite people to look at the work of Rachel Yehuda specifically and listen to her talk about it. She's very, very, very dialed on that front. And I will say too that, you know, the language, because some of this content also gets into trauma content, right?
Right.
What people say when they experience a traumatic event is, I wasn't the same again, right? And that's the same language that's often used by people who have a transformational experience with psychedelics. I wasn't the same again, right? So you can have an experience that changes you in either direction.
Thank you for not just focusing on the negative and showing that this can also be a positive experience, because it incentivizes people to work with these medicines to break those cycles for the positive and the negative. Even if they're not in immense suffering, mm-hmm. they can evolve themselves.
Yes.
And if you want to have kids, this is great work to do before you have kids. Yeah. You can kind of empty the backpack. You can let go of some stuff and not pass it on and put your kids in a better position than we were birthed into.
Yeah. And have the opportunity to really create consciously, right? Because there's a lot of unconscious creation, and that often comes with baggage that, you know, maybe you don't need to carry. Maybe you can choose to say, okay, I'm going to put that down. And do something a little bit different here, which, by the way, I think is a real beautiful way to honor the ancestors, to say, we don't need that anymore.
Right.
And, you know, one thing that has been kind of dropped in at a couple different points that I want to speak to, because I'm very passionate about it, is, you know, just drugs in general. Drugs are so hyper-stigmatized, and we have a tendency, myself included, to create more hierarchies around them. These drugs are good and these drugs are bad.
Right.
And I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. I think that there's – what matters is how we engage with anything. It's not the thing that's the problem. It's the – and maybe there isn't a problem, but how. It's the intention. Now, people engage in a psychoactive substance, including alcohol, including cocaine, including whatever, including sex and work and other things. People engage – either to create connection, to be in expansion, in the discovery, in the recovery, in the more connectivity, or it's departure, right? And when people are leaving, they're usually leaving because their internal resourcing is overwhelmed by what's happening.
Huh.
Okay? So when I see someone who's coming in with an addictive process, I am on some level grateful that they have something to go on, right? And I wish for and work with people to develop more skillful inner resourcing, more skillful ways of being in this life experience as it is. And it's full of all kinds of stuff, and it's not easy all the time, right? And I have so much compassion for people who are involved in addictive processes. And I think that there's a tendency to make it a moral failing and a problem. And that's shaming. Like, people are struggling when they're in addiction. Right. And we need to really change our context around that, which I believe also includes changing the way that we talk about and think about drugs in general.
Right.
Because these drugs are good, these drugs are bad. I don't believe that. And you know, I did my clinical training years as, you know, a recovering anorexic at the time in the desire to understand addiction more myself. And I wasn't someone that was, you know, engaging with substances at the time. I was engaging with not eating. But I looked at, I became a certified alcohol and substance abuse counselor in addition to my degree. And I did my training at a drug and alcohol treatment facility that was populated by people as an alternative to incarceration.
Wow.
So I was working with the prison population.
Oh, wow.
Now, let me tell you, that was the most, like, one of the most profound psychedelic trips of my life. It was the only bad one, and I have not recovered from it.
Well, I'm so glad you're bringing this up because, and I thank you for also, because the persecution of drugs, the persecution of people, it begets more trauma.
Yes.
And if we have systems in place that are imbuing people with trauma, you're not just punishing that person, you're punishing their family, you're traumatizing their family, you're traumatizing their children, you're passing this on, and you're perpetuating this, whether you want to call it behavior of criminality or whatever, the pain that led to that criminality or led to that addiction. So we need to move to a rehabilitation model. Can you tell us about your experience working with the prison systems and perhaps how we could learn from sort of, you know, everything you're talking about in terms of a rehabilitation model, integrating, you know, understanding intergenerational trauma and how that's perpetuated through the systems. I would love for you to kind of dive into all of that. This is one of the things that fascinates me the most.
Same. This is a real passion area of mine. And the context that I hold for psychedelic is that we're all tripping all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we're tripping right now.
Dude, I get told in ceremony all the time, you're always in ceremony. Life's a ceremony.
That is exactly right. That is exactly right. It's a one giant, like, trip.
Yep.
And it's the word psychedelic. It came to be when Aldous Huxley was talking to Humphrey Osmond in 1956. And it was in many ways a course correction for the word psycho to mimetic, which means, you know, replicating psychosis. So they created a word which basically means mind expansion or soul revealing. I hope this conversation is that for some people. It is that way for me just to be sitting and sharing this with you, right? It's expansive. And so it's all a trip. And I don't want to be in psychedelic exceptionalism with drugs. And it's been a journey for me in understanding these things and in breaking through the matrix of what I have been taught, right? And what we have been taught. So I come from, of course, the DARE era, from the just say no era, from the anyone who's using drugs is a derelict and a bad person era. And that's really been my context, had been my context. So when I was in my clinical training, working at Samaritan Village, which is a therapeutic community, I was seeing people as a very, very ill-equipped young therapist who were mandated to see me. And I was ill-equipped because I had no experience. I was in school. And, you know, like I said, it was people who were in this place, this residential place, as an alternative to incarceration. And so they were there on drug charges. And it was a predominantly, you know, a population of Black and brown people. And, you know, I was called the white lady, which felt weird to me, but kind of made sense. And I heard all of these stories about how drugs decimated their lives. And not because of the ways in which they were taking them, but because of how the world was interacting with them in smoking a joint or doing whatever they're doing, right? Selling, whatever. Nobody should be in jail for marijuana. We have so many people, like, I mean, the numbers are astonishing. And then we have white billionaires on weed, right? Right.
And privatized prison systems, you know, it's extreme, you know, so Woo. It's profitable for people to be in prison. I think it's 300,000, 350,000 last I checked a year. That's how much it costs, to keep one person in prison. So, I mean, it should not be such a lucrative model to keep people incarcerated, especially with lobbies and prison guard unions. It really motivates this incarceration model that is systemically unjust, ill, and very racist. Also.
Well, all of our drug policies are essentially racist policies.
Yes, 100%. Thank you.
The war on drugs is a war on people of color, period.
Yep.
And we, in this country, converted other countries by essentially threatening not to trade with them, to adopt these policies.
Are you talking about the UN when we put terrible?
But, at the turn of the century, people were able to get morphine and opium and all these things at CVS. Duane Reade, you just go to the stores, no problem. And people did not present the kinds of problems that we have come to see. The drugs were legal. And the policies, the Harrison Narcotics Act in the early teens and then subsequent laws with Nixon when he declared the war on drugs, public enemy number one, went down then to create the drug scheduling laws, which essentially just targeted the populations of people who were engaging with particular substances in order to subjugate them. There has never been any science to any of this, ever. None. And yet we have these very firmly rooted beliefs and ideas about these drugs, including cocaine, including, heroin. And I'm a big fan of Carl Hart, huge fan of his work. Real matrix spending conversation he's having and very confrontive. And we need to be confronting these ideas that we have. Where did they come from? What are they good? Right. And for me, they're definitely huge problems. And We need to do better. We need to do better because essentially it's maintaining slavery.
Right. And do you think if we were, let's say, it's revolution happening, the shift is happening, the show is a symptom of that shift that's happening. Do you see a world where psychedelics could be implemented into the prison systems to help begin that healing like they do in South America with meditation and yoga and ayahuasca ceremonies?
I'll choose hope every time.
Yeah, me too.
I don't think we're anywhere near that. I think we need to look at places like Portugal, who, Portugal was in a massive crisis. One out of 100 people was addicted to heroin in the late 90s.
Whoa.
And overnight, decriminalized everything. Overnight. Because they were in total crisis, in total breakdown. And what they were doing, stuffing their citizens in jail, wasn't working. And what happened, unless a person was carrying a large substance for, mass distribution and sale, you get caught carrying whatever you're carrying, you get access to healthcare. And what happened was drug use went down, and violent crime went down.
Wow.
And, the spread of HIV and Hep C went down. And, overdose rates plummeted. It had previously been per capita one of the most intense places for people, for that. And I think in 2015 or 16, the United States had 50 times more overdose per capita than Portugal, which decriminalized everything.
Wow.
So that's a model that we should think about, right? The criminalizing also places that moral judgment. And I think one area that we in the psychedelic community need to adopt is how do we step out of psychedelic exceptionalism? How do we get off our high horse and say and I've been in plant medicine ceremonies where people say, well, I wouldn't touch a synthetic. There's judgment about MDMA or ketamine in certain ayahuasca circles I've been part of. And there's judgment, right, about these different things. I'm like, well, stop. These drugs, especially, in the psychedelic worlds, they create a sense of magnanimous, acceptance and love and this and that. So, but we're still judging.
Right. There is, because for me, there is such a difference between something like ayahuasca and mushrooms to, let's say, and I work with MDMA often, to MDMA, ketamine, LSD, but there's still tools. It's like you said, it's the how, not the what.
Yes.
It's how we use it. And another thing is it perpetuates, one, this ego and this hierarchy, and we're just perpetuating this subjugation model. And this is right, this is wrong. Yeah. Okay. They're different. But at the same time, we need repression is always going to be a problem. If you look at something like, let's say, the Catholic Church, where there's a lot of sexual repression and it leads to sexual abuse and pedophilia. And what happens after that? It leads to the cover up of that. Repression is never good. We need to look into the shadow, shine the light on the shadow, and love every part of ourself, every part of society, and be just everything that exists can be done consciously and in balance with the highest good of ourself and the all. And any sort of, I call it a Christian distortion of good and evil, of this is bad and this is good, is going to be inherently problematic. Mm-hmm. Yes, you can say this is right for me and this is, you know, this is less right for me. And everyone's also on an individual level.
Yeah,
you know?
So respect each other and our choices, right? Instead of coming on, you know, with judgment. So that's something that I'm really, really committed to and working on, because I have in my body certain reactions when I hear heroin, for example. Right.
It's a good example. Yeah.
Right. Or cocaine. It's like I have a somatic response to that.
Somatic? Is that the word used? What does somatic mean?
Body-based.
Oh, wow.
Like there's something like, there's a trigger. You know, I hear ayahuasca, it's like very neutral for me. Now, for some other people, they may hear ayahuasca and have a trigger.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? But I'm tracking me, and I'm tracking my judgments, and I'm tracking my conditioning, and I'm tracking like the world that we live in, and wanting to create a world in which people have respect, no matter what they're doing. You know, if they're not harming someone else.
Right, right. Well said. And I have a question. So when you were doing that work within the prison systems, you know, does that intersect with generational trauma? You know, I mean, obviously when you're seeing like this model that is abusing, whether it's the drug war or whether it's the incarceration model that is abusing and manipulating and enslaving people of color, you know, how does that, you know, intersect with generational trauma? As we know, people of color, you know, especially in America, have massive, massive trauma. You know, I really would like to see more and more people of color come to the medicine.
Yeah.
You know, more and more people of color in the psychedelic space, because of all of this. But would you see symptoms of generational trauma in your work at the prison systems? I know you were young at the time.
Yeah, I was. I didn't have a context to understand it, but I heard their stories. I heard the stories of the people that taught me. They taught me. I'm so grateful. I'm so humbled. I as a clinician, like I love, it's the biggest tool that I have in my toolkit. I can love with boundaries, right? Yeah. You know, that's like love has become a bastardized word in my field. I love my clients and I loved them when I started.
Why is it bastardized?
Because it gets like sexualized. Carl Jung called it unconditional positive regard. That's the clinical jargon. I love my people. And if I don't, I probably shouldn't work with them. I need to be able to see the magic and the goodness and the special spice in each person, see their possibilities and see them, like really like see them through the suffering, through the veils, through the dying process into their lives. And the clients that I worked with, I heard their stories, right? About their lives as little people. And there is repetition compulsion, right? Like there's stories, right? There's stories that these people's dads aren't around, right? Like a lot of them are around and a lot of them aren't around. And that's true for white people too, right? But like what I noticed was like stories of pain in an environment and in a system and in a context that was like concrete for growth, right? Like how do you get out? How do you get out? It was hard to get out.
Right.
And that was very clear to me. As I mentioned, my sister died. My parents had their stuff. They didn't have a perfect marriage. My sister was sick as I was growing up, but I had privilege, right? And I had a safe environment, and I had, my nervous system may not have felt safe, but it was a very different world that I came from. And then stepping into that world as the therapist, like, I mean, sometimes the clients would be like, "What do you know about like the hood, Lauren?" I'm like, "That's a great question. I don't really know anything. I don't really know anything, like, you know." But I'm here to listen. And you know, I remember there was one client, because again, they were mandated to see me. They didn't want to talk to the white lady or like this like therapist, that young girl who like, I get it. But there was one guy who would just sit there and not really answer any questions. And when I said, "Do you want to tell me how much it sucks to be here? You want to tell me how much you don't want to be here?" And he cracked a smile, and that was the beginning for us.
Hey gang, pardon the interruption. We'll be back after a quick break from our sponsors. Sorry for the interruption. More Awakened Underground now.
We all have the tendency to repeat what we learned.
Right.
And that goes back, all the way back, right? And then if we don't have an environment that's nourishing, that's safe, right? Then we can often fall back into these patterns because we know how to live in them. And if it is unsafe, then our nervous system gets titrated to that lack of safety and we'll right. pursue it because the system wants homeostasis.
Mm, I love that. Yeah, mimesis is a massive issue. You know, it's a survival mechanism found in nature where it's a fear mechanism where a organism will mimic its environment to better blend in, to better survive. And an interesting thing about awakening is when I would, you know, kind of post working with medicine, I'd start to like look into some ancient texts and I'd find certain old religions talk about it as the rebel. It was the same archetype as the rebel. It was the person who rejects the cultural program to find enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And understanding that enlightenment is not necessarily going to be found in this mimetic model. It's not going to be found necessarily in the mainstream because look symptomatically, look at our culture. We are a sick culture.
Yes.
So by just an observation, you can see this is not an awakened society.
No.
You know, so it's 100% going to be found outside of the current model. You know, there's going to take some rejection and some reprogramming and deprogramming. And that's really the beauty of the death experience to go back that is you are dying to this old program, which is tied to your old self. So, I mean, and, you know, we're coming to the end of our time a bit here. So, I mean, I guess the main thing I'd like to take this back to generational trauma here.
Yeah.
And one thing I want to say is because some people don't have access or aren't ready for psychedelics, one thing I like to say for them, a place to start is looking into your history, talking to your family, looking at the historical, cultural events they went through, societal events, you know, talk to them, get an understanding of what they went through, and it might give you a better understanding of yourself and also increase those connections. But beyond that, what would you say for people, whether it's working with psychedelics or without, how can they begin to broach becoming conscious of potential trauma that's been passed down to them and how to begin to heal that trauma with or without psychedelic medicines?
Yeah. First of all, I want to acknowledge that within each one of us, we also have generational healing and power. We have generational blessings and support. We are supported, all of us. And I want to invite people to be in their bodies. I want to invite people to get curious about their bodies. So to be in a body-based practice, whether that looks like yoga, running, walking, dancing, to get into the body, right? Like this isn't a mental exercise. This is a body-based experience being human.
Oh, true. Nice.
And I'm not against the mind. I love my mind and I've learned to be friends with my mind. But the mind can you know, hijack the system in a way that's very painful for people. So let's start to kind of take a bottom-up approach. Be in the body, check in with your heart. And then can you watch your mind? Can you bear witness to the happenings without attaching so firmly, right? So creating a little bit of space. A spaciousness to explore your experience. And for me, it's breath, sound, movement, and touch. That's one of my teachers, Brianna Cavion.
Love that.
It's really good, right?
Breath, sound, movement, and touch.
Yes, breath, sound, movement, and touch. These are the keys to emotional and spiritual digestion.
Whoa.
And that's true in a journey, and that's true in life. Can you breathe through it? Sound, music is one of my favorites. Like I love to listen to evocative music that stimulates an opening of my heart in a way that a medicine might, right? And I don't necessarily need the medicine to open my heart. And the music becomes a medicine.
Yep.
Moving again, like again, my practice is a very like somatic body-based experience. Like I want to be in this thing while I have it.
Yep.
Because I don't get it for that long.
I love that. All movement is medicine. All movement is medicine.
And you got to shake it off. Like animals in the wild, if they see something scary, they'll shake and that's how they like get over it.
Absolutely.
We freeze. So move your body and also touch, right? Like we're so often touch deprived, but your own hands on your own body is also a potent medicine. And to find the places and spaces where like you're able to nourish, where you're able to like, oh, okay, feels good. And notice, right? Like where it feels good for me, it might not feel good for you. But what does feel good for you? And to be in that like gentle exploration, right? To be sweet with yourself.
I love that. And also this is going to go off a little bit on a tangent, but what Lauren's doing right now when she's talking about touching herself, she's putting her hand over her right hand over her heart, left hand over her stomach, you know, you have energy centers in your hands. I'm a licensed Reiki practitioner. We unconsciously use this all the time. You're anxious, you hold your heart, you know, or your stomach hurts, you put your hand on your stomach. Your friend is suffering and crying, you put their hand on the back of their heart and kind of rub their back. You know, your head hurts, you put your hand on your head. We unconsciously do this. We can start to wake up to the fact that it can imbue a flow of energy and vitality to put your hands, you know, especially in your energy centers or over your heart, that can help get you in your heart and out of your head. And it's a very simple practice that all of us can do within or without, outside of medicine. So I love, love, love that you're touching upon this. I mean, I want to ask you something real quick.
Yeah, please, please.
We're really running past the time. When I'm finding and seeing people, I've healed physical illnesses, literally stress fractures. Like I have scans of fractures in my brain, physical trauma that's happened, seen so many people, car accidents, physical trauma, heal it psycho-spiritually in medicine. What is that? How do you have any understanding or insights into this phenomenon that we're finding?
Yeah. Well, the body keeps the score. The body keeps the score. The issues are in the tissues, and we can heal through feeling. And you know, my job isn't to make people feel better; it's to make them feel more, right? And to allow for the whole experience to come and complete, right? And Joseph Campbell says, ecstasy is any feeling fully felt. Like, I have been in ecstasy with my grief and my fear at times. And, you know, some of this implies a safe container for these explorations. But we absolutely can heal the body by integrating the experience and by letting it go.
I love that. Resistance to pain is suffering.
Prolongs it.
Exactly. There's you can have an ecstatic, enlightened awakening experience through pain, through perhaps a tattoo or anything like that. I love that. And because we're at the end of our space, last thing,
yes,
last
please.
Question.
Yes.
If you got one song to sing, one thing to say for the world, like, what would you like to share? What's the one thing you would like to share with the world if you were leaving this rock later on today? Like, what do you got for us, sis?
If it isn't love, it isn't real. Like, keep going deeper into your own heart. And when you find yourself there, you'll be in the center of everyone else's. Keep going.
Facts. Thank you.
You're
love
so
you.
Welcome.
You're amazing. Thank you for taking the time to come on the show. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate the work you're doing and your vulnerability and how transparent and loving. And thank you for bringing love to the work. Like, thank you for bringing love to your patients. Like, thank you for transcending that old apathetic model. You know, apathy is a way of the past, and it's got to go. We got to open up to each other, and that's how we're going to heal. And I'm so grateful for you. Seriously.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. What a pleasure and privilege. Thank you. Thank you.
That's our show. Thank you for listening to the Awakened Underground podcast. We appreciate your time, attention, and support. Please be sure to hit the subscribe button. Throughout the season, we will be interviewing doctors, scientists, shamans, thought leaders, and celebrities who work with psychedelic medicines and are ready to come out from the underground to share their stories of healing with the world and what these medicines have to teach us about the true nature of reality. The Awakened Underground is a production of Calvary Audio in association with iHeartRadio. The Awakened Underground is created, hosted, and written by Cody Blue, directed by Tanya Dahl, produced by Cody Blue and Jeff Apple, executive produced by Dana Bernetti and Keegan Rosenberger, co-executive produced by Jason Seagraves and Brandon Morgan, post-supervision by Josh Windisch, and sound design and sound editing by Jesse Perlstein. And a very special thanks to Daniel DeLoreto, Eric Klein, Alexander Genisi, Armand Zadie, David Grillo of Thank You Plant Medicine, our teachers, First Nations people, our ancestors, our families, and these sacred plants.